On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For much of the 20th century, tough lines were drawn around the world between capitalist and communist countries and economies. Now, communism is all but gone, and some economists are saying it's time to draw new lines between kinds of capitalism, between good capitalism and bad capitalism. Good as in open, dynamic, entrepreneurial, bad as in state-run or oligarchic systems sewn up for the rich. They're putting the great debate over what works best for the most in a whole new frame. Up next on Point, good capitalism, bad capitalism, and the lives we lead. Joining me today, two of the authors of the new book, Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism. From New York, economist William Baumol is here. The Economist magazine calls him the leading thinker about economics of innovation. He's a professor of entrepreneurship at New York University's School of Business, professor emeritus at Princeton. William Baumol, thanks very much for joining us today.
A pleasure, and thank you.
And with us from Kansas City, Missouri, Robert Leiten, Vice President for Research and Policy at the Kauffman Foundation and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Together with Carl Schramm, he and William Baumol have just come out with Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, and the Economics of Growth and Prosperity. Robert Leiten, thank you very much for being here today. Hello, Robert Leiten, are you there? Kansas
yes.
City, hello. Good, good.
Yes.
It's terrific to have both of you with us, and thanks very much for joining us. I wish you'd begin to walk us in. If there's not just one kind of capitalism, and you say, or it's said that maybe the only thing that they share in common is that they all respect private property, you've got four kinds. Robert Leiten, I wish you'd just take us quickly through those so we can begin to see the lay of the land before we dive in deep.
Okay, I and my co-authors talk about these four types sort of in order. Starting from the bottom first, we take oligarchic capitalism, which means what it implies, namely that the power and the money is concentrated in the hands of a few. The problem with oligarchs is that, by and large, they don't care as a first priority about maximizing growth. Economic growth for their people. They care mostly about what they can take for themselves.
Countries that exemplify this oligarchic capitalism would include such as?
Yeah, examples would be much of Latin America, certainly portions of Africa. Russia would be the paradigmatic case. And there are probably elements of oligarchies in various other parts of the world.
Okay, there's what you call the worst kind. And then?
Then would be state-guided capitalism, which we find in Southeast Asia, obviously in China and in India. These are economies where the state doesn't necessarily own all the means of production, but they either own portions of the banking system or they use a variety of incentives to pick winners and losers. And this kind of capitalism can be good for long stretches of time if you're far behind the leaders and you want to catch up because you have a target to shoot for.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with state-guided capitalism is that left to its devices long enough, states are probably not going to be as good at picking the next winners at the frontier of economic activity, so to speak, as the private sector.
So good to get going, good to catch up with, not necessarily a good long-term bet, then we come where?
Then we get to big firm or bureaucratic capitalism, which we find in Europe and Japan, where now you've been successful and you've concentrated a lot of your economic activity in your large firms. And in Europe, some of them are called national champions, and the state supports the growth of them, the best example, of course, being Airbus.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with bureaucratic capitalism is bureaucracies tend to be good at incremental innovation, but not very good at the next big thing, or what we in the book call radical innovation.
Okay, then you come to the innovation frontier and your fourth and final form?
And there we are at the frontier, and that's entrepreneurial capitalism. The leading exemplar, of course, would be the United States, but there are other countries that look like us now. Ireland, Israel, Taiwan for many decades has been very entrepreneurial. And there are entrepreneurial sectors, obviously, in India, in China. And the thrust of our argument is in the book, and we have to credit Will Baumol for this insight many years ago, and that is you can't have an economy entirely full of entrepreneurs. You need a mix.
Sounds like we may have lost Robert Lighten for a minute there.
We've got you.
Yes, a mix. And you say the U.S. has it, of entrepreneurs to innovate and big firms to pick things up and mass produce them.
That's exactly right. And you can have different mixes in different economies. But unless you've got a healthy dose of entrepreneurship, you're not going to come up with the next big thing.
William Baumol, you're the grand master in this realm. You've been watching for a long time, paying a lot of attention to entrepreneurship in particular. You know, one way to read your book is to come away with the message that you're saying the U.S. has, when it comes to economics, the best of all possible worlds. Is that it?
Oh, no, hardly so. We still have many things that beg for improvement. But compared to the Europeans, for example, we have a number of advantages that have enabled us to keep on growing and staying ahead of those who only a few years ago were expected to catch up and surpass us.
For example, Japan, when it was, Japan is number one. And these days, some people see China in that role. Do you see China somehow working with its state-guided capitalism in a way that could surpass the United States? Many do.
Well, my line on what's going to happen is that the only thing I predict about the future is that it will surprise me. So I don't know whether anyone is about to pass us, and history says that eventually, no doubt, someone will. But at the moment, the way China is progressing, I would think it much more likely to be like the history of France and Germany and the post-war world, when they were growing much faster than we were because they had more to learn from us than we had to learn from them. But as soon as they got fairly close to us, they could now had to rely on their own inventiveness and entrepreneurship. And suddenly the situation changed. They could not keep up with our rate of growth.
Robert Lighten, you've got kind of an institutional interest in entrepreneurship. Kauffman Foundation is all about that. In full disclosure, I've been out to your Kansas City headquarters and been wined and dined in an earlier entrepreneurial chapter of my own life. Big supporters of that whole notion, originally financed by a very successful entrepreneur. So justify your case for the supreme importance of entrepreneurship. What exactly is that role on that innovation frontier that they play? Why couldn't it be played just as well other ways?
Well, we've had the unique advantage at the foundation of being able to fund the research of a large number of economists. And so we can take a bird's eye view of this research. And what it tells us is that the big new breakthroughs, many of them, if not a good portion of them, have been commercialized by entrepreneurs in the last 100 years, for example. If you look at things like the automobile, air conditioning, airplane, personal computer, internet search engines, and the list goes on, you'll see that those inventions were successfully commercialized not by the GEs or the IBMs of their day, but by... We've got AT&T with the transistor in the mid-50s. Today we have Toyota and Honda with the hybrid car. But by and large, I would say these breakthrough innovations are exceptions. But once having had the breakthroughs, as we talked about earlier, you do need big firms to help refine them and commercialize them. And so often the first person to the race, if you will, is not necessarily the winner. Example being, of course, Microsoft was not the first one in the operating space for personal computers. Apple was, but Microsoft came along and did it better.
William Baumol, let me ask you then, if the U.S. has got it so right, why has the so-called, in the 90s, everybody talked about the Washington Consensus, and we had the right cookie cutter, and we were going to cut cookies around the world. There's a lot of resistance to that around the planet right now. If the U.S. has got the formula so right, why that resistance abroad? And what about the problems at home? Inequality we hear a lot about, job insecurity we hear a lot about, outsourcing and all the rest. Pick up those if you would.
Well, each one of them has a different story. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, we are far from a platonic ideal. we're just ahead of the others in our imperfection. But the main thing is that the Washington consensus focused very much on macroeconomic policy, on curbing inflation, mm-hmm. on getting the interest rates attractive. And we believe that those are important. We don't claim that we have one magic elixir, but that leaving out the entrepreneur as the spearhead of growth on the microeconomic side is a performance of Hamlet with the Prince of Denmark absent.
I love it. We're talking this hour with the co-authors of the new book, Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, looking at the many ways capitalism is practiced around the world, the pros and cons of different ways that countries and economies make a buck. A little later in the hour, we'll be joined by Robert Kuttner, co-editor of The American Prospect. He's got a little different way of framing good and bad capitalism. We've already got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let me go to Shane in Augusta, Georgia. Shane, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? I'm a big, big, big fan of the show, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Wonderful to have you.
Basically, I had a discussion last night with my girlfriend about the North American Union, about the basically continental trade policies.
That's very romantic, Shane.
I'm a sweet talker, but basically, I guess I was wondering if that would be considered, because it kind of tends to squelch out the middle class, some of the policies, maybe the labor policies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's usually large companies, large big firms, as you're talking about, that are involved.
Yep.
With these kind of policies. And I was kind of wondering your panel, for an opinion on that.
It's a great question. William Baumol, Robert Lighton, how about it? We're opening the borders more and more. You've got Canada and Mexico becoming, part of the play in a big way. Shane sees what that means for big companies. Is that good capitalism, bad capitalism? How does it intersect?
Well, I draw a mixed conclusion from it. The fact is that we have been facing the competition of cheap foreign labor for a long, long time. When I was very young, which was before the Civil War, the newspapers were full of the unfair competition of cheap foreign labor, but our standards of living, our wages kept going up and up, and the reason was because then, as now, we were spearheading the world in terms of rate of invention, in terms of Nobel Prizes, in terms of entrepreneurial activities that, unlike medieval China and its gunpowder and its compass and its spinning wheel, unlike them, we actually put these inventions to work.
That's great and glorious, Shane might say, but he's watching the middle class and worried about their fate amidst all this innovation and how they fare when those things may not be built here. Maybe they get invented here, but built somewhere else.
Well, it's true. Go ahead, Will.
Sorry. Yes, some of them should be built elsewhere. After all, a richer China or a richer India will also become better customers of the United States. We do have threats that face us, but it is not growing or elimination of poverty in the rest of the world.
Let me go to Tom in Somerville, Massachusetts. Tom, you're on the air, and Shane, thanks very much for your call. Tom, what do you say?
Hi. Great show. But I really have to disagree with the list of types of capitalism proposed at the top, and I want to disagree with the fact that the United States is at the top of that list. From my view, we're at the bottom of that list.
Why? What do you see out there?
Well, the example that they gave of the oligarchic capitalism mm-hmm. in the bottom of the list was Latin America, and I used to live in Latin America, and I'll tell you, I see no difference really between their type of capitalism and our type of capitalism today.
Is that applause for Latin America or a criticism of the U.S. style? I mean, you can certainly see stark differences between rich and poor in Latin America.
Of what the U.S. Capitalism has devolved into in recent years. The only difference is down there, when something was, when you want to get something done, you bribe public officials with cash. Here, that money is laundered through political action committees, and all the big corporations have figured out that the biggest return on your investment are political payoffs.
Mm-hmm.
They donate $100,000 to each campaign, and they get a $10 billion contract back. Where can you get a better return on investment than that? That is not free market in any way, and our you know, quote unquote free market in this country has not given us better health care. It has not given us better media coverage of events. You know, it fails, and there is a place for government to intervene in capitalism and to correct the market where there are market failures.
Tom, we've got it. Robert Lytan, how about it? There is a tough criticism. There's huge inequality in Latin America. So there is here, too. You know, I used to go down and see the broken glass on top of the walls around walled compounds where the rich were and think, never in my country. But we've got an awful lot of walled communities here now. Tom says, talk about a powerful, wealthy class. It's hard for the U.S. to throw stones these days. He says it's we've got the same thing here, oligarchic. What do you say, Robert?
Well, several things. First is I share the view that our system is not perfect, and I'm the last person who's going to defend our campaign finance system. But one thing that differs between the United States and Latin America, certainly, is that we have lots of people giving to money, giving money to K Street lobbyists in Washington. And one of the problems, in fact, with our economy is that they all cancel each other out. Economists call this activity rent-seeking.
Yeah, but who's the they? You're talking maybe about big industry, but it's not the same if you're the oil industry or you're Tom in Somerville, Massachusetts. They're not giving the same amount.
Well, look, it's not just big industry that's in K Street. You've got the small business lobby. You've got the Chamber of Commerce. You have the trial lawyers. You have public interest groups. You have virtually a who's who list that seems to be growing over time.
So you don't think more money buys more sway in the American political economy today?
Well, it buys it, but there are a lot of competing sources of power and influence. If you look at Latin America, and I just want to make the final 2 points, is you don't have as many diverse interests seeking power and influence. That's point one. Mm. And point two, the level of inequality in Latin America, as you referred to, is just light years worse than it is in the United States. And point three is that even people at the bottom of the ladder in the United States are far better off than they are in Latin America.
William Baumol, how about it? I heard recently that inequality in this country is as severe as it's been since the 1920s, sort of a Gilded Age. Is that a refutation of the beauty of our economic balance?
Once again, you're accusing me of claiming that all is beautiful here. And I disagree violently.
But you do put us at the top of the heap. You hold the U.S. up as the exemplar.
As better, sometimes marginally better, in terms of growth, not in terms of equality by any means, but compare the growth rate, steady, substantial, cumulative in the United States, whereas in Latin America we have had countries whose per capita standard of living, GDP, has been going down for as much as a decade. And that's not an easy trick in a world of innovation, of improved productivity. They have to be damn good at destroying productivity to have it go down steadily.
And nothing to sneeze at the U.S., which has been on a fairly strong growth curve. You're saying nothing to sneeze at there.
Yeah. That's right. But go ahead, Will.
No, so that in the sense of growth, which is ultimately the way you can eliminate poverty, if you adopt other policies that are appropriate, we have the material with which you can reduce and eliminate poverty. I don't believe we're doing nearly enough for that, but Latin America does not have those resources, and that is the result of the very inefficient form of capitalism that prevails there.
So it's all relative in a way. Criticisms can be made in many directions. We wonder about the weight of criticisms pointed right here, but there is that growth beneath it, and, you know, I guess hallelujah for that in economic terms. William Baumol, Robert Lighten, please stand by for a moment if you'd be good enough. I want to welcome into our conversation Robert Kuttner. He's co-founder and co-editor of the magazine The American Prospect, author of Everything for Sale and the forthcoming The Squandering of America. Robert Kuttner, thanks very much for being here.
Delighted to be part of the conversation.
So here's the big title on a pretty big book, Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism. You've cracked the pages. What do you find?
Well, I rushed out and got the book, and I think it's a terrific book about the importance of entrepreneurship and the preconditions of entrepreneurship. But I was a little bit disappointed, and I suppose in a sense this is unfair because you're criticizing the dog for not being a cat, but I would think a book titled Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism would also look at things like social balance, what brand of capitalism is also consistent with a broad diffusion of prosperity. And secondly, I was looking for the chapter on the excess financialization of the American economy and the global economy, the excesses of hedge funds, private equity, the overdependence on foreign borrowing from Asian central banks, the huge trade imbalance, and I didn't find very much on that, and I think that's also a particular pathology of American capitalism right now. And I guess the third thing I would have been interested in more of, which I'm interested in myself, is the question of the interface between different brands of capitalism. What sort of ground rules are appropriate when you have a state-led economy like China that's been growing at 10% a year, trading with a more laissez-faire economy like the United States, trading with European economies that spend more on social outlay. This is much more complicated than just the question of being in favor of free trade or being in favor of protectionism. It's a question of what kind of ground rules are appropriate. And I think what's interesting is that 20 years ago, people were talking about the convergence of capitalism into one model that would look pretty much like American capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
I think, if anything, you've had divergence. I mean, the Chinese have shown all too well that you can have a blend of Leninism and capitalism and grow at a prodigious rate for a longer period of time than a lot of people thought. You have kleptocapitalism on the part of some of the oil-producing countries.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the African dictatorships, and certainly in the part of Russia. And you have, despite the disparagement of Europe, at least the Nordics are doing remarkably well by combining social investment of a much greater degree than we have with a great degree of flexibility, so that instead of trying to protect existing workers in existing jobs, you make it possible for them to get better jobs and new jobs by putting a lot more money into education and training. I mean, I was in Copenhagen recently, and the head of one of the biggest unions said to me, Danish industry needs to do more outsourcing. And I sort of caught my breath. And she said, we are a small country. We're an export country. We need our multinational export corporations to be competitive. I said, how can you possibly be for that? And she said, well, we have a national strategy where if you lose a job, you get a better job. And we have social investment to that end. So I think the absence of social balance and the excess financialization of the American economy at the expense of real entrepreneurship would demote it to some extent on my list.
Robert Kuttner, stand by. William Baumol, we'll look at those, the diffusion of prosperity, the financialization. But let's go first to the interface question that Bob Kuttner raises. You describe four different stripes of capitalism here. We're interfacing like crazy with, for example, the Chinese, the state-guided capitalism right now. You may like the American balance better, but do we end up nevertheless disadvantaged when we face the kind of Chinese amalgamum that's out there right now?
Oh, yes, we may. Let me first say that I'm an avid reader and admirer of the American Prospect, and that I have no basic disagreement with what we've just said.
Mm.
And there are cases where we do have to worry about the terms of trade and the special advantages that the Chinese may give to their export industries, etc. But by and large, the history of the world in the past two centuries, with its explosion of productivity and per capita income, has entailed growth of trade of unimaginable proportion.
But let me ask you, you know, we went to war, Cold War at least, to push against another economic system, communism. So what about the lines you're drawing here? Are they that serious? I mean, that's an extreme playing out of a bad interface. But do we have, you know, the trend may be right, but you know, we took this seriously before during communism. Is state-guided capitalism a sufficient threat that we need to, you know, have, I don't know, the economic equivalent of war?
Well, I'll jump in there.
Well,
I think the difference with Russia, of course, is that at the time we were fighting capitalism, we were fearful that they were proselytizing it actively with military aid and so forth
fighting
in the
communism.
Rest of the world.
Yeah.
Yes, and so we were not only fighting an economic system, we were fighting an authoritarian political system that was backed by nuclear weapons.
China is also an authoritarian political system backed by nuclear weapons.
But nowhere near what Russia has. And secondly, China is not in anywhere, in, at least in my view, they're not out there busy fomenting revolution to the extent that the Russians were, let's say, in the 1950s or 60s. At least we were fearful of that.
But China is a revolution. It's an economic revolution. It's a status quo revolution. I mean, to take your distinction seriously,
right,
are they significant enough that we need to champion them beyond this kind of modeled market that you describe, or do we just go with the flow and trust in our system to prevail for everyone's benefit?
Well, let's look at China. I'll just finish,
okay,
and then
yep,
you know
yep.
we'll
sure.
take the handoff.
Yeah,
you know, if you look at China, you know, where Bob Kuttner, and by the way, I'm a fan of a lot of Bob Kuttner's writing, so we have a mutual admiration society here. Where Bob sees a lot of divergence, I actually see some convergence. If you look at China 20, 30 years ago, they weren't a state-guided economy. They were a communist country
that
was state-owned. They weren't even capitalist. And so today we have a system that is part state-directed, part entrepreneurship, leading in an entrepreneurial direction. Ditto for India. India was overwhelmingly a state-directed economy, and now as we see in various parts of the information technology sector in India, they are moving in an entrepreneurial direction. That's 40% of the people in the world in those two countries. So I actually see systems that are moving closer to us. And in fact, that's one of the reasons we seem to be so nervous about them.
There's a lot to say, but let me get our listeners in. Paul, in Watertown, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I buy into the sort of fundamental argument that the good thing about capitalism is that the best way to allocate resources is that people act in their own self-interest. But I see that self-interest as too narrowly conceived, and I think our system is sort of inherently short-term, both because of the stock market and because of election cycles. And there's sort of no constituency or no voice to speak for long-term problems like Social Security and pollution and things that can have consequences that are like 50 or 100 years out.
Right.
So I wonder from your guests, two questions. One is, how do we compare with other systems in that area? And secondly, well, what are, from an economist's point of view, the proper corrective measures for that to incorporate that interest into decision-making?
Paul, it's terrific. Let us pick it up. Robert Baumol, how about it? The long-term kind of issues that Paul is concerned about there, let's say global warming, pollution, he cites just for one.
We are misbehaving inexcusably in the United States in relation to global warming, to inequality, to a variety of issues. So I fully agree with our last listener on those points.
Is that misbehavior endemic to our brand of capitalism?
No,
it baked in the cake?
Not. Look at Sweden, which has essentially something close to our form of capitalism. It does have less of an incentive for entrepreneurship than we have.
Sweden is like American capitalism? I mean, I know a lot of conservatives who would snort right out of the barn on that.
Well, that may be, but behind their backs, the Swedes have managed to have both big firms and small firms, have managed to have a lot of innovation. And incidentally, as the givers of Nobel Prizes, they are also in the top rank along with us once you correct for the differences in population.
So Paul also asked then, what's the prescriptive measure? If we're behaving miserably within our system on some of these very important fronts, what's the corrective, he asks?
Can I jump in?
One moment. William Baumol?
Yes, the answer is that we do have to start dealing better with the poor. We do have to provide universal health care and end the scandal of all the children who have inadequate education and inadequate care for their physical well-being. I mean, the list of prescriptions, many of them obvious, is very extensive. But we are the best growth machine so far, and without growth, you cannot pay for those necessary improvements.
Robert Kuttner, are you prepared to wait for the growth to fix it, or are these problems part and parcel of this growth-making balance that we strike in this country?
Well, they're part and parcel of who has the political power, and that's one of the things that economists don't look at very much. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Sweden and Denmark is they managed to have the growth and a much greater degree of equity because their institutions are somewhat different and the constellation of political power is different. I mean, Sweden and Denmark, 80 to 85% of the workforce, including the white-collar workers and a lot of professionals, are members of unions. So it creates a completely different political constellation. And I think if you compare the U.S. the first 25 years after World War II and then the next 25 years, for the first 25 years, productivity growth and GDP growth and the diffusion of that growth were just about on the same path. It was people and the bottom half and the top half benefited about equally. If you look at the last 25 years, productivity's gone through the roof, particularly in the last 15, but inequality has also gone through the roof. One incredible statistic, in the 5 years between 2000 and 2005, productivity was up 19%, and exactly 3% of the workforce got real raises. It all went to the top. And that's not a function of growth or a function of the particular stage of the market economy that we happen to be at. It's a function of the fact that all of the equalizing institutions that were characteristic of the early post-war period have been taken apart one by one because the right wing has so much political power. So I think a lot of this, good capitalism, bad capitalism, boils down to what Galbraith called countervailing institutions. And although Bob Lighton, in talking about K Street, suggested that, you know, if you net out all the different interest groups,
right, everybody's
they're
in
all
there.
Mm-hmm. I think you have it right that the interest groups that represent the biggest dogs have the most influence in setting policy, and the countervailing institutions are much weaker, and that's why we have such inequality.
Bob Lighton, how about it? You, as a supporter of entrepreneurship, you support entrepreneurs being able to make a killing on their innovations. I think many Americans do, and yet we see what's happened with inequality, with the diffusion of prosperity, as Bob Kuttner says. Is it a blinkered view of our economic system and its balance to just look at growth and not rate it in part on the rest of what's going on? Would you still put it at the top of the heap in terms of sort of assessing it against other types when you look holistically at it?
Well, I think Will and I share the view, and I think Carl does too, that at the end of the day, the most important thing for economies is growth. I would say very close behind is an equal distribution of the gains, or at least equal distribution in proportion to people's skill and contribution. And the great shortfall in America that Will has referred to, and we all know about it, is our K through 12 educational system, where we have massive numbers of kids who are either dropping out or not performing well. And when those kids don't, when they don't perform well, they grow up to be low wage earners. And until we address that problem, we're not going to have an improvement on the equality front. And I will tell you, from at least my perspective, that one of the things we need to do on the educational front is do something probably what Bob Kuntner disagrees with, is move away from a reliance on the prescriptions advocated by the teachers' unions. We need more choice in education. We need people who are in low-income areas liberated to be able to choose their own schools.
Will Bomwell, you talk about this miserable or misbehaving horribly on a lot of these fronts. Let me come back to that. Is there a structural connection possibly between the economic, the balance of capitalism, big firm and entrepreneurial we've got here that you guys are very enamored of, and these outcomes, even on, let's say, public education? Are these somehow connected at a political economy level?
No. Well, at the political level, I agree with Mr. Kuntner that is where the fault lies. And this, you see, we've gotten a little confused in not recognizing where the difference lies among the three examples, the Latin American mm-hmm. countries, the U.S., and Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
In the Latin American countries, you have had per capita incomes declining and distribution dreadful. In the United States, we've had per capita income rising steadily, but we have not eliminated poverty. We have not done enough to care for the health and the education of the poorest. In Sweden, for example, where I have lived, you do have the growth mechanism, but you have also adopted measures which may have slowed that growth slightly, but in my view, it was well worthwhile because it has virtually eliminated the sort of immiseration of the poor that we have in the U.S.
We have a lot of listeners who want to get right in here. Gabrielle in Lowell, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Gabrielle. When we look at the question, good capitalism, bad capitalism, mm-hmm. and whether we have good capitalism and could make it better, I think we need to ask ourselves what we mean by that. I mean, what does good mean and good for whom? And if we, for example, look at growth as a parameter to measure our quality, then it's the question whether this is actually a good parameter, because the question is whether growth is sustainable for eternity. And, I mean, what we have caused with our economic system is not necessarily good for society or good for the continent, not for the continent, for the Earth, for our planet. So I think we have to measure those questions.
So there's some skepticism about the basic measure itself being applied here. Growth, Bob Kuntner, what do you say to that? Growth is the be-all, end-all, or at least the primary measure.
Well, I think growth is terribly important. I think the recent history proves that growth is necessary, but it's not sufficient. The distribution of growth is partly a matter of education, but it's partly a matter of political institutions, equalizing institutions like Social Security or progressive taxation or trade unions. I think with a different set of policies, we can continue having growth and not destroy the planet. But in order to do that, as Sir Nicholas Stern, the former chief economist of the World Bank, wrote, global climate change is the biggest single case of market failure in the history of the world, and it relies on extra market decision-making forces to use market incentives to create outcomes that go beyond how markets price goods. So I think to say that we have to sacrifice growth in order to save the planet is to play a losing hand, because most people want greater prosperity, but I think we need to do it in a very different way, and that requires public policies to countermand what oil companies and coal companies and other representatives of the free market would otherwise do with our planet.
But let me ask you about those countervailing institutions. William Baumol says, this is we got the right system, but we're just not weaving the right politics or policies around it. And my question's still there. Is there something about the balance of big firm capitalism and entrepreneurial capitalism that we've got that is leading us to inequality, to ignoring some of these larger social balance issues?
Well, I'll quote Tonto's famous line to the Lone Ranger, what you mean we? And the question is, how has the we, the decision makers in this country, changed in the past quarter century? And I would say it's gotten much more highly concentrated. The decision makers are more beholden to people of concentrated wealth. And as a result, you get decisions about the political ground rules and the policy ground rules that don't serve ordinary people, that do serve those very same forces of concentrated wealth.
Let's take a couple calls. John in Lafayette, Indiana. John, you're on the air.
As I have traveled to 50 countries and just got back from Mexico City, everything that the 1% that control the hundreds and hundreds of trillions of dollars flowing every month, every year, they have no initiation to ever give it to the poor or middle class. They have every initiation to take it away from the poor and class, to take away their land rights, their legal rights to live and own their own land. And it will never change as long as these 1% are 100% selfish for themselves.
Yeah, but John, look around at this country. There have been a lot of rich people over a couple of centuries here, and yet there's been a rising standard of living in general, maybe not fast enough recently. You must see that.
I don't. I just came back from New Orleans. I see $3,000 RVs and 300,000 empty poorhouses, and then I go to the rich highland places, and it's like I see the richest, untouched by the hurricane, and they got aid. If they needed aid, they got immediate aid. And for another 5 or 10 years, New Orleans, those houses will still be nothing.
John, we've got it, and thanks for your call. Let's get one more from Charles in Lansing, Tennessee. Charles, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom, thanks. It seems to me the problem is simply our exponentially expanding debt. Our GDP and productivity is simply chasing that debt up, which will eventually explode because it's an exponential situation. Perhaps they could comment on that.
Yes, sir. Bob Lighton, what about it? There's two big ones, inequality and debt, and listeners, in a sense, asking, are these sustainable?
Well, certainly the debt situation's not, and we point that out in our book. And in fact, if listeners watched 60 Minutes this past Sunday, they saw a rerun of David Walker, as the Comptroller General of the United States, pointing out what the listeners have said, that we have an unsustainable public debt driven by entitlement programs largely, or the growth entitlement programs, and the age and the aging of our population. And we have got to do something about that.
Well, what about the lowering of taxes on the richest Americans?
I think that in retrospect, we should have had a phased-in. If we were going to have any tax cut, we should have had a bounce back, and the tax cut should have been phased out, because we face a growing, in fact, staggering budget deficit in the future. That's my own personal opinion. So I may be agreeing with some of the listeners there.
And inequality, do you see it as a kind of potentially explosive challenge to the economic balance that you like here?
I think in the long run, if the current trends that we have all talked about on this show continue and things get worse, yes, it is potentially explosive because it can shatter the social fabric in the country, and it can lead to policies that could severely dampen growth. And here's where probably I may differ with some people. I think one of the populist backlashes could be a severe restriction on trade, which actually would harm our growth in the long run by not keeping the winners in our economy on their toes and applying the hot breath of competition, what they need to sustain their entrepreneurial drive. So I am very worried about inequality, and it's something that we've got to do. And as I said, the root cause of it, in my view, is the educational system.
Will Bommel, you've got the longest view here. We go to you for the last word. What's your level of optimism in the U.S. balance of capitalism, that it will be sustained, that it will keep bringing us growth, and that it will be managed in a way that prosperity produced is shared?
But I think the picture we've gotten in the last few minutes is precisely right. I agree with George Bernard Shaw that there is no greater crime than poverty. And growth is important not for itself, but because it gives us the instruments, it gives us the resources with which we can fight it. But until the politics are revised so that they do permit that to happen, then we do face a very serious danger for society.
And with that, we're out of time. William Bommel and Robert Lighton, co-authors with Carl Schramm of Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, thank you very much for being here. And Bob Kuttner, co-editor of The American Prospect, thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.